Hello and welcome back to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, librarians, and publishers about books, ideas, and the creation and circulation of knowledge. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. We've been away on summer holiday, and so this will be the first edition of our second year on the air. Our guest today is Nicholas Adams, architectural historian and professor of art at Vassar College. Nick is here to talk with us about his new monograph on one of the 20th century's best-known and most prolific architectural firms. The book is entitled Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, SOM since 1936. It was originally published in Italy by Elekta and is out in this country now and is published by Feiden. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you.
Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill was responsible, perhaps more than any other architectural firm or even individual architect, for the popularization and certainly proliferation of modern architecture in the United States through the second half of the 20th century. The firm is credited with over 10,000 projects that include everything from individual buildings to corporate parks and headquarters to entire academic campuses to complete towns to the present layout of the Washington Mall. It has had a profound impact on the way modern buildings are planned, designed, and constructed. It has altered the skyline of most of our major cities and is responsible for most of the tallest buildings in the world, including the Sears and Hancock Towers in Chicago, the Jin Mao Tower in Shanghai, and now the Burj Dubai in Dubai. Yet very little has been written about the firm as a source of cultural and historical influence or as a phenomenon in itself. And my question is, why do you think this is the case?
Well, that's a big question, Tom, because as you rightly point out, it is a remarkably prolific firm. 10,000 buildings over 70 years works out roughly a building every 96 hours. And when you start to think, as you walk through cities, how many places this firm has put its mark, it is striking that it seems to have had relatively little attention from scholarly study and from architectural historians in general. I think probably the first reason is that SOM is associated with corporate architecture, associated with business. So the first thing that happens is that it requires one to study a large firm with a large number of employees working in diverse architectural styles. This, by its nature, is in some ways opposed to the way we usually study the history of art or the history of architecture. We think of advanced architecture or advanced art as being the work of a single group or a single unit, an avant-garde clique that sets itself out to change the world, that gathers adherents, that develops its ideas. In the case of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, we're dealing with a firm that employing upwards of 1,000 architects in three different sites in many different styles. So I think in all ways, both as a firm which is well known to be tied to corporate America, as a large firm with a diverse style, and with the fact that it sometimes is seen as representing the way things are rather than the way they ought to be, there is a certain bias against this kind of a firm.
It doesn't work well with a sort of cult of the individual approach.
Oh, no. No. I mean, the idea, indeed, the firm itself, after all, we've got three names here, Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, not one of which is alive, not one of which was the designer. So we're already faced with the fact that this firm presents an image to us in general, which seems really opposed to the cult of the individual or the great hero architect. Indeed, now it's just reduced to SOM. What is that?
So apart from this lacuna in the historical record, were there other reasons that inspired you to undertake this project, which must have taken a considerable amount of time and part of your life, I suspect, right?
It did take up some part of my life, but a good part, I would say. Actually, it's perhaps this is another strike against these kinds of things. It is that terrible kind of book. It's commissioned. It was commissioned by the publisher, Elekta, in Italy, and their very imaginative and inspired editor, Francesco Dalco, who approached me and asked me if I'd be willing to do it. So the understanding was that the book would be written for Elekta, for an Italian audience first and foremost, that SOM agreed to help and participate and to designate it as a monograph that they were enabling, but actually they had no control over the book in any way.
So this isn't an authorized biography?
No, no, by no means. I mean, I'd say not that it's unsympathetic to the idea of a large firm, not that it's unsympathetic to investigating what it is that makes a firm live so long, develop in so many ways. It was really the first attempt to try and describe it as a whole. And, of course, if you'd had to have that approved by a board of directors, a board of partners, since they're all part owners, it would never get through. Yeah. 33 people could never agree on what the story is because they all see it from a different perspective. So I think it was the only way it could be done. And I hope it's both interesting to people who are interested in architecture, but also is seen by SOM as something that fairly represents them.
It seems to work as a window into this period, a very important period in the history of architecture in the second half of the 20th century, so I expect...
Well, thank you, but I think it's an incredibly exciting period, and I think the fact that SOM is not represented in our books in general is an oversight. Here's why. America post-war is a period of optimism, of expansion, a period in which invention seems to be possible. SOM gets hired in that period over and over because they had never done something like that before. And that to me becomes very interesting, so that each time they get asked in, whether it's into Terrace Plaza, the great hotel in Cincinnati, even to Lever House, great office tower in Manhattan, the reason is that these are seen to be inventive and imaginative people. Now, the question for us is, well, what is it about that period that makes their work so important? That is, they seem to capture at that moment the sense of American optimism, that expansion that takes place after World War II. They embody corporate culture. Every time somebody wants to do something of a business nature, they seem to turn to SOM. They're the answer. And I think that as we are interested in American history, as we're interested in the place of America in the world, the place of American architecture is interesting too.
So, well, the first thing I noticed about your book was the photography, which is absolutely stunning throughout, and there's a lot of it. And in fact, the photographs carry much of the content of the book, particularly in the chapters on individual buildings and projects. And what I mean is that the photography conveys an experience of the architecture that goes beyond the usual function of illustration. Was this something you meant to do, and can you talk a bit about the relationship between photography and architecture?
Well, I think photography is a very important part of the book. I mean, this is a book in the history of architecture, and it's a book that I think is luscious in appearance. SOM, very early on, made contact with a young photographer working out of New York by the name of Ezra Stoller. Stoller had an architectural degree as well as being a fine photographer. And the account that is given of architecture in these photographs is really an essential part of the telling. That is, the building in glass and steel seen as isolated against the city. The sense of the wonderful light that plays through the transparent structure in these buildings. Well, that's part of the building, but it's also part of the imagery that the photograph communicates about the buildings and about the firm. There's a wonderful photograph that is by now a kind of classic that shows Manufacturers Trust, one of the first glass and steel facaded bank buildings, on Fifth Avenue, 43rd Street, and it shows the safe that the architects placed in the window. A wonderful idea. You see your money right in front of you, right? And then it shows a photograph is taken at night with a man in a raincoat standing looking in at the safe. And I think the image both of comfort, the sense of the man's intrigue or interest in it, the figure turned away from you who looks into the building, means that the building has a kind of almost a curiosity about it. What is it that makes this man so interesting?
And that was one of Stoller's photos.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, Stoller's photographs are really throughout. We did our best in this book to there was some discussion about whether we should try and get new photography, and we decided not because the buildings themselves are more than 50 years old in many instances and hard to photograph today and to get their original aspect. Mm-hmm. We thought also about using some color photography from Stoller, and we have some. But even there, we haven't adjusted the color. In some cases, these are negatives that have decayed slightly over time. The color's been lost. But we've printed them as they exist today. So they have a certain kind of antiquated, they have an older look to them rather than being kind of luscious, glossy.
They're quite striking, though, as works of art themselves seem to be. They remind me of some of Steichen's architectural photography.
Yes, I think they have that. They have a great quality. And I think you feel that a story is being told about the city as well as about the building.
Yeah. Of course, one doesn't experience architecture like one experiences a photograph, right? When you physically enter a building or see a building, Walter Benjamin talks about experiencing architecture in a distracted state.
Yes, I mean, it's not the same thing. And today, in certain instances, when you go to buildings, a lot of things have happened to them, particularly these buildings over time, that makes it hard to appreciate. I think the photograph, there is an element of eye candy involved. Certain color photography of architecture has been referred to even as soft porn about architecture. There are photographers who make the colors even too luscious. I think here the criticism could be that the photographs are quite cool, but I think that's very deliberate, and I think we have to pay attention to it. I think the photographs are telling us not just about the buildings, but they're also telling us about how these architects saw their buildings, and indeed how the world saw their buildings. Mm-hmm. There's actually an example which I can give, which is this a marvelous photograph of the Pepsi-Cola building, which is up on 59th Street and Park Avenue. One of the things you realize when you look at the photography is that they want to tell you all the time the new buildings are different from the rest of the city. Mm-hmm. The new buildings stand out from the things that are around them. Pepsi-Cola, which has been, as it were, surrounded now by a rather too sympathetic renovation effort with a tower behind it, which seeks to match the forms of Pepsi-Cola. In fact, in the original photography, what you see they're trying to get at is that the building is separate from the things around it, and that's something that the photography can bring out.
Make it stand out, yeah. Certainly the founders of SOM must have had an idea when they hired Stoller about what they wanted photography to do, and they were very astute about salesmanship and selling a product.
Yes, I think so, and Stoller is very much the selling point for so many of the photographs, and indeed, I heard as I was going around interviewing people in relation to the building that in Chicago, where Stoller obviously didn't live, there was great competition to get Stoller out to photograph one's buildings because they wanted the buildings being built by the Chicago office of SOM to have the same look as those that came out of the New York office. So Stoller becomes the coin of the architectural realm for SOM, particularly in the 50s and 60s.
Well, that's interesting. So I want to go on and talk about the founders of the firm and the people who are associated with it. But before we get to that, I wanted to talk a bit about how you went about doing your research, since that's one of the interests of this program.
Well, in this case, it was an interesting situation. How do you research 10,000 buildings over 70 years?
Yeah.
Here was the problem. We haven't explained, but there are different offices of SOM. The offices in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco, who are the most active today, maintain their materials and their resources in different ways. The archival, the primary material, for example, in Chicago is incredibly rich. So rich that one could never complete an overview of the firm if you went to them. So, for example, under the very efficient management of Karen Witte there, if you ask for a project built by the Chicago office, they deliver you a room full of documents.
Oh, really? So they have excellent archives.
Excellent archives.
As opposed to many architectural firms and private architects that keep no records at all.
That's right. If you go to the New York office, where they were extremely gracious and very helpful, one could request certain things, but say, for example, the early drawings for Lever House were listed in their archival source book, but in fact what came out were the electrical plans from 1978. Mm. So there's a great deal of unevenness in the way in which you can get access. In fact, the Chicago situation makes it almost impossible to write a book about the firm because you drown in paper, whereas New York gives you nothing whatsoever.
so
you're kind of stuck in between. What I did, in fact, was to write the book out of a combination of interviews, oral histories, of which there are a number prepared by the Art Institute in Chicago and by Betty Bloom, which are very helpful, which were done with SOM partners. There were some shorter interviews done out of the New York office with retiring architects, and the extensive periodical literature, and some internal material that came from SOM that happened to have found its way into the publicity files. So we had to kind of knit these things together.
So marketing offices are sometimes helpful.
Marketing offices can turn out, for example, with some statements about what the building is supposed to do, or public relations documents that may indeed be edited by people, and so you get a sense of the change. And I had a parenthetically an extremely able Vassar student, Miranda Kimball, who helped me with a lot of this research.
Your own interviews, did you record those or?
Some I did. Some were done by telephone, some were done in person. John Winkler, for example, who was managing partner of the New York office for many years and who lives indeed near Vassar, was an extremely helpful source and helped sort out the organization for me. Those were interviews that were not recorded, but I certainly recorded others. Natalie Dubois, whom I met, who was an early designer for SOM, working out of the New York office initially and then later in Chicago. I went out to Chicago and met her. Walter Netsch, whom I met, an extraordinary figure, I also met and talked with. So it was a range.
So when you, I'm interested as a librarian, when you do these interviews, would it be useful to have these things archived somewhere, the interviews that you've recorded, or don't they really constitute oral history in the sense that a formal sit-down oral history.
No, they were not formal sit-down oral history. Yeah. And partly that was because the formal sit-down oral histories that were done out of Chicago were so strong. What I was looking for was the kinds of things that could describe how a project came into being. I mean, one of the things that's most frustrating is really about what's missing. Mm-hmm. So what's missing? Early sketches. Early proposals. Mm-hmm. So I was often just asking people how two or three buildings came into being or what went on in the thinking around them. And I didn't feel that they didn't have that quality.
Not necessary. I wonder now that people are designing not with pencil and paper but on CAD, what's happening to the legacy of individual projects, especially as software changes.
Yes, you won't be able to read it.
You won't be able to read it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is a good question. I mean, I have to say our interest in architectural drawing does not have that long a history. I mean, I recall a former colleague telling me about working for Philip Johnson's office in the mid-70s when Johnson would do sketches. The younger members of the firm knew to fish them out of the waste paper basket and keep them. But the older ones just threw them away. And I do think that there is actually a particular character, it may even be characteristic of SOM, a surprising indifference to the historical record.
Yeah.
I mean, surprising because as a historian I'm fascinated by it and I don't understand why they aren't quite at the same level. But if you're building that many buildings, you are looking on to the next. And there are many buildings where the historical record is extremely poor. And indeed, to make the decision, I mean, to go to your point about computer-designed material, to decide to save the material is also an investment in cost.
Mm-hmm.
And firms are not always willing to make it, and I think in some instances SOM doesn't bother to make it. I think in other instances they have made that.
I suppose on our part as librarians and educators, it might behoove us to be looking to fulfill this kind of function sometimes. I think for architectural firms, the way the Philadelphia Athenaeum seems to try to do for Philadelphia architects, they gather up everything they possibly can after a project.
I think that is a good idea. I think the difficulty in the case of SOM, I mean, I have talked with people both within the firm and then also without who would be interested, but here's the problem. If you've got 10,000 buildings, who's going to look after the drawings? Yeah. Who's going to take care of it? Yeah. You have legal issues that also arise. But there is, for example, a very obvious connection between one of the great architects of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, Myron Goldsmith, and the Canadian Center for Architecture. And I've always thought that it would be terrific to get the project drawings that were done for Goldsmith's buildings in Chicago up to Canada, because they already have a private archive of Myron Goldsmith. And I think those things will happen. I know Adrian Smith, for example, has arrangements, the nature of which I don't particularly know, but involves moving much of his own archive to the Chicago Art Institute. But this is not a typical story.
It's not systematic.
And it does carry financial implications. Yeah. I mean,
you have a very interesting and unusual, if not unique, dedication in your book, a very sort of Bauhaus, it seemed to me, in that it pays homage to the collaborative work that went into making what is, I should say, a really beautiful piece of craftsmanship in the book. And it's so unusual, I thought I might read it aloud, if I might. It reads, "This book is dedicated to those who dug the foundations, lettered the working drawings, cut the friskets, adjusted the computer programs, and whose names find no space in a book of this sort. In the context of the modern worship of the celebrity, the study of SOM forcibly reminds one that making architecture depends on teamwork, institutional cooperation, and the continuity of architectural generations." And then across from your dedication here, you have this wonderful photograph of about 10 floors of the tower at Chase Manhattan, loaded up with, I counted, at least 1,000 members of the construction crews, mainly, that put the building up. Before the building was skinned, you can see them all scant standing on various floors. And the opening seems to serve to remind one that a book like this is itself a kind of architectural object, and it also presents your book very much in the spirit of collective endeavor that SOM is all about, as you say.
Well, I think that, thank you for noticing this. I mean, I've studied individual architects by and large. I've done work on urbanism, but we tend to be interested in names. Society as a whole has its so-called starchitects, the star architects who attract attention. No one can say that SOM lacks for attention in a general way. It seems to be around a lot. It's big enough and all that. But I thought that there was something very interesting about the way in which collaborative work took place there, that in effect there was no single personality to the firm, and that each of the individuals, highly eccentric in their own way, each of the individuals subsumed their individuality in the collective, at least over the long term. They may at certain moments have asserted themselves as individual citizens, as architects. Gordon Bunshaft had certainly a forceful, if not abrasive, personality. But in the long run, it was SOM that counted, and making the institution function was and is important for the people who direct it. And in some way, that is against the trend of American society, which seems to put more and more place and weight on individuals. You know, there's something also about it, and I think that motivated it. I often had the feeling, I mean, SOM is a place in which there is a lot of sharp-elbowed competition within the firm. And the way in which those sharp elbows function with one another often reminds me of an academic institution.
Yeah.
That is to say, people are looking for advantage, looking to get ahead, but the stakes are rather different than they might be, let's say, on Wall Street. So I found that interesting, and I thought that actually against my own expectations, I expected to find a dull group of faceless individuals, and what I found was a wonderfully vibrant, rich, small society of architects. So in a way, I wanted to do that. And plus, the fact is that architecture is a collaborative undertaking.
Yeah.
Let's face it, it doesn't happen with one person. Books don't happen with one person. One tries to bring on and acknowledge the people who do real things for you and make it possible.
Yes.
So the image was meant to...
Yeah, it's sort of like filmmaking, I would think.
Yes, it can be like filmmaking in the sense that if you look at certain architects today, they actually function much more as film directors, yeah, calling in the specialists. Oddly, SOM is slightly the reverse in the sense that they have the specialists inside the firm.
Yeah. So. Interesting thing about this particular photograph is, apart from the fact that it gives you an idea of the people who build the building, it's part of a tradition of group photography that comes especially out of World War II,
yes,
that tells you something about the strength of American industry. And
that's
I have
right.
these memories of seeing photographs of literally hundreds of assembly workers standing on the wings of B-24s rolling out of
yes,
a Willow Run.
Yes, well, I think that seeing this as war work is not wrong. I think America in the 50s and 60s, and certainly in Chase Tower, they really thought that they were colonizing the world for civilization.
Yeah. And at the time, was there any other country in the world where you had structures this size going up with this
no.
many people putting them up and
no.
projects this large that no. had to be managed?
No. I mean, that remains the appeal, I think, for numbers of people at working with SOM. that you get to build big buildings or you get to have significant planning influence. But to return to your note about the sense of the collectivity and the value of these buildings, I always like to quote, but I'm always interested in the way in which these buildings really spoke to the heart of what American society thought it was about. So that when Lewis Mumford comes to review Lever House for the New Yorker, he describes it as a laughing refutation of imperialist warmongering and an implicit symbol of hope for a peaceful world. Now that's breathtaking. If a building fulfills that responsibility, it's no wonder that people want to stand out and be seen. They're helping all this take place.
SOM, as you mentioned in the book, is a collaborative organization. It doesn't have a hierarchical structure, at least it didn't for most of its history.
No, it's a flat organization. There's often been somebody who was more powerful than others, but the power was really granted through the strength of their will. You have a number of partners, unspecified, approximately 30 at the moment, split between different offices with different responsibilities, who jointly run the firm, who maintain studios. I think one of the things, if one thinks of the kinds of things that surprise one about SOM, one of the things that surprised me was to find how quickly young people could move through the firm. Because there's no set style, oddly, there's greater freedom. Who would have thought it? Corporate America would offer greater freedom than the possibility of working for some individual architect. But in fact, it's the case. A building by Richard Meyer needs to look like a work by Richard Meyer. A building by Frank Gehry needs to look like a building by Frank Gehry. Whether those particular individuals had a specific hand in it, a building by SOM can look like something that it wants to be. And I think that adherence to a kind of modernist rationality, you know, it's always a target that one shoots for, it isn't something one achieves every time, is actually a circumstance that allows young people to move through the firm. So it is a remarkably flat organizational system and allows great freedom as a result. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to say that this is a firm with multi-sites. Mm-hmm. There are three major offices at this point, New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But there are also offices in Shanghai and in London. Now that's to differentiate these from job offices. These are places where partners are established, where the firm has been active for a numbers of years. And I think it was conceived of by Skidmore and Owings, it seems sweet to think of it that way, as a hedge against the dangers of depression. Mm-hmm. These were both young men, Skidmore and Owings, who'd been deeply marked by the depression.
That's interesting.
And they thought that if they had a firm, they had one in Portland for a while, if they had them in different parts of the country. If things were down in New York, they'd be up in Portland. If they were down in Chicago, they might be up in San Francisco. So that was really a way to keep the firm afloat.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's characteristic. Now, today, you just pass it over and say, well, they must have those offices that's there because they have business. Yeah, but in fact, there is a significant history. And that leads to this hydra-headed firm, with people becoming, therefore, princes in their own realm.
Notwithstanding this emphasis on organizational culture, SOM has employed architects whose names resound in the literature of modern architectural history. People like Gordon Bunshaft, Fazlur Khan, Myron Goldsmith, Walter Netsch, whom you mentioned, Chuck Bassett, David Childs, and many others. And I find it interesting the way in which the personalities of these individual architects have left their mark on the overall organization, even if these personalities may be in some respects subsumed over the long term. And especially, this is the case, I think, with the firm's founders. Lewis Skidmore and Nat Owings were brothers-in-law?
Correct, yes. Lewis Skidmore met Nat Owings' sister when she was effectively doing her JYA, but was in Paris. They met, fell in love, and were married when they returned to the United States. She had, after all, the brother, Nat. They became, I would say, close. It was not an intimate relationship by any means. And in effect, that's really the foundation. They complemented one another, I think one could say.
Yeah. They're very different guys.
Totally different.
Very interesting, though, both of them.
Yes. Both kids who had started from disadvantaged backgrounds in Indiana. Skidmore was meticulous, elegant. He waxed his mustache. Owings was boisterous, loud, joyful, enthusiastic. people describe his tie as always being food-stained. Skidmore was an exquisite designer and draftsman. Owings was not. Owings knew how to get along with people. And Skidmore had a great eye for design. It's probably fair to say that Owings' taste in these matters was at times suspect. His taste in other people could be absolutely spot on, at other times was somewhat doubtful. And so they complimented one another, and they brought in their third partner, John Merrill, who was an old drinking companion, whose firm had fallen apart, who was an engineer architect, to make the third member in the group.
The firm, to some extent, seems to have been stamped early on by the work that was done for the Chicago Century of Progress exhibition, do you think?
Yes, 1933 was the critical breakthrough. It wasn't yet Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. That is, it was a job that Skidmore had received to build the Century of Progress exhibit, and he brought along his brother-in-law. And I think they learned, while working on the Century of Progress exhibit, where they had, incidentally, very little money for construction, very little leverage with architects, they learned there how to build fast, how to build efficiently, and they learned how to build attractively so that it would draw people in, make buildings exciting, make them selling points, in effect.
Showmanship seems to be a big part of this, and it is an exhibition, after all. There are amusement rides.
Yep.
The things are done in facade where there isn't really any actual building standing behind them.
Well, Skidmore kept saying over and over again, your building has to actually tell a story. It has to give some message across. He understood this perfectly about how to design exhibition spaces, and much of the early work there afterwards, the job that they got that brought them to New York was designing an exhibition space for bathrooms and toilets at the American Radiator Building, and that got them a New York office.
The big idea wasn't that the...
I think there was a vision involved, although it's not clear what the vision was, but always clear that your building had to communicate something, and in those early buildings, the power of communication was really strong.
And in the exhibition, and then later on in the New York World's Fair, the firm really had to learn how to organize other people to do
things, right? I think this is one of those things that we tend to slightly underestimate. That is, it was not just about making designs on a page and having somebody else do them. It was about organizing men to do them, and it's something that they learned on these hurry-up schedules at exhibitions, both in 33 in Chicago and then in 39 in New York. So the New York exhibition becomes a further demonstration. And I think once you learn the skills of how to organize the building site and get people coming along in the right sequence, you first you save money, but secondly you work efficiently. And that was something that they learned with great skill, a skill which then was reinforced when the war was ended and you brought back people who had spent, young men, mostly men, who had spent their time organizing war material, and they were very, very important for the firm.
And then another major project that the firm was engaged in early on was the Oak Ridge project in Tennessee, which itself was a massive undertaking.
Yes, an enormous undertaking and highly secretive. I mean, that's those moments when I have to say, as you research it and you get intrigued by it, you kind of sit back and are just in awe of these people. Skidmore received a visit from someone from Washington who said that he wanted them to design a city for 75,000 people in a site that he couldn't specify, for a purpose that he couldn't specify, and asked whether the firm would take on this job. Now, any rational person would have said no, and I think there's something almost irrational, daring about this. They said yes, and then worked for a long time, finally got to see the site, and finally put the site together under the cloak of wartime secrecy. Well, perhaps one did it then, but it still is there's an element of daring.
And this, of course, is where the atomic bomb was developed.
Where the atomic bomb is developed. There were wonderful secrets connected with this. I met with Louis Skidmore Jr., who's a architect in Houston, and the son of Louis Skidmore. And he tells of his father being given a letter in a sealed envelope if he ever had any problem paying the workmen for the project, he should take this to a bank and give them the letter, and it would solve everything.
Oh,
he never had to do that.
No.
Cloak and dagger stuff.
So in what ways was Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill innovative? I know they helped to bring women into prominence in American architecture with Natalie Dubois and Gertrude Kurvis.
Yes, they did. I think this is a byproduct of being a large firm.
Yeah.
But in fact, people like Natalie Dubois and Gertrude Kurvis and others moved through the firm. I think SOM had women partners relatively late, and it's not a perfectly balanced institution in the ways that academic institutions like to be. But that may also be the profession of architecture as a whole.
They're one of the first architectural practices to make use of computers.
Yes,
in
very
a
early on.
Way.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you think about the innovations that the firm developed, there is no question that they mastered the techniques of the curtain wall very early on. That is to say, those glass and steel envelopes that enclose modern structures. Computers came in early, although they can come in, at least as I was able to piece it together very early on, through the accounting department, because no one will pay for them for design.
Uh-huh.
And they enter very early on into an agreement with IBM, developing their own software, their own techniques for design and for the measurings of structure that are done with IBM. And then ultimately move out of that market as PCs become more powerful and other players enter the field. But they're very important early on. There's a wonderful description that an employee gave me of the first fly through the city of Chicago that was done. And this was the early moment when computer technology was used. And it was apparently, for those who were there, one of those life-changing experiences.
SOM isn't particularly known for its theoretical work, although it's had important partners who have contributed to architectural theory, like Walter Netsch.
Yes, I mean, Walter Netsch's ideas about field theory, and Myron Goldsmith, with his discussions of scale and structure. No, it's not a theoretical firm. It's a firm about doing and acting. Gordon Bunshaft is one of the great figures, a man that I liken to a fox. That is, he just simply moved from place to place as it was interesting to him. He was not a hedgehog. He didn't follow one idea to its final conclusion.
He was from the firm almost from the beginning, wasn't he?
Yes, from 1937. You know, when one talks about, again, about corporate America, it is also surprising. You mentioned the women that have come in. It was always surprising to people that this firm, which is so associated with the blue blood American corporate architecture, its critical design partner was Jewish, as were a number of others. And so it was a firm that, in its quiet way, opened doors. Mm-hmm. Walter Netsch, for example, held in the 60s sessions in which architects sat and talked about the problems of the day, consciousness raising about racial divide in America. So there's interesting things happen. And I think things that one just can't cover it over with the notion that there's a corporate firm and white bread and why should we be interested. I think there's a range of experiences. You know, you can say about SOM, if you like, what is sometimes said about the state of California. Everything they say about it is true. it is the most wonderful. Yeah. The most wonderful things can happen there, and then there's the most banal.
Yeah.
And there's great diversity and variety, and there's great similarity, and all these things go together in a large...
There was a kind of critical conflict in the firm in the 1950s, though, wasn't there, with Bruce Graham Chicago office?
Yes, but particularly in the 50s and 60s. I mean, I think that what you were seeing was a transfer of power from generation. Here's the picture. Following the war, I think it's fair to say that Gordon Bunshaft in the New York office felt that New York was the key site of activity, and it was clear that Gordon Bunshaft wanted to be the one who was the controlling figure for design. More than the facilitator, he wanted to be the one who actually determined what happened, and everybody should come to him, and this was the case for Chuck Bassett out in San Francisco, and it was the case for Bruce Graham and Walter Netsch, both of whom got their starts with Bunshaft. Now, when they developed their own client base, they're of course freed from Gordon Bunshaft, and I think there were tensions between Graham and Bunshaft, certainly between Bunshaft and Bassett. Bunshaft told Bassett in no uncertain terms he should get out of architecture. He didn't, and he had a very successful career, but he was not doing it in the way that Gordon wanted. I think it's the way in which the founding figures, and Bunshaft wasn't a founding figure, but he was there right at the beginning. He was there in the first 3 minutes, you might say, make the transition from being a small group of people who are able to promulgate one way of doing things to a larger firm that does a multiplicity.
And is there also a tension here that's being played out in architecture in general in the nation in terms of a philosophy that emphasizes maximizing profits for a structure and one that focuses on design principles?
Well, that's one of the perennial tensions of architecture. And it can be a tension within SOM. I mean, you have a whole new group of value engineers coming in who want to tell you that you shouldn't spend more than $125 on a door frame, that you shouldn't add in walls, that you shouldn't have your building break line. That is to say, there are a number of buildings that one can observe where you see a straight line curtain wall running from floor to top. The architect proposed that there should be setbacks, that it should be less monumental. The client said, I ain't paying for that. Yeah. And I think that's something that SOM has had to deal with as much as, certainly, but perhaps more than other firms. I think that's why one of the other sides of SOM is this interest in art that always finds a place, both even today and also historically, that the use of sculpture, whether it's through the Rockefellers, but even for the beginning with Terrace Plaza in Cincinnati, and even in places like Leverhaus, where you have people like Noguchi who are involved from the beginning, but all the way through, even up to today, where you see people like James Turrell who are working with Roger Duffy. SOM has always tried to make art a part of the structure.
Yeah, and that was rather innovative.
Very innovative in the early days. Yeah. It's always interesting because art doesn't, compared to a building, cost that much. But if we look at the Vassar campus as a particular point, it's surprising how little art is integrated into buildings.
Yeah.
It just isn't the way we do things. Yeah. I'm not sure why, but it is actually a practice here, and it's done with great effect. The Rockefeller collections at Chase were an integral part of the building. All right, Rockefeller's involved, stand aside. But there still is an awful lot of that.
So with the rise of postmodernism in the 1980s, SOM found itself on the receiving end of an avalanche of criticism directed at high modernism and the international style in general, and at SOM in particular, since the firm, as we mentioned, was a great force in promulgating this modernism. And it took a while for the firm to adjust to this paradigm shift, didn't it, both in terms of philosophy and also as a matter of pure business?
Yes, I think this was a critical moment. It was a moment, not unsurprising in some way, a firm which is known for a certain sort of architecture. When the taste changes, obviously you can do one of two things. You can shrivel up and die, or you can adapt. SOM had faced particular criticism, as it would, because it was in so many places. Mm-hmm. It was everywhere. And it was doing things that in the 1950s and 60s were seen as imaginative and inventive, were completely in tune with the times, and then all of a sudden they were out of tune with the times. So yes, it was a problem. There was a period of retrenchment. Yeah. Certainly many people lost jobs. Yeah. This was painful.
The numbers of architects working, partners, went way down, didn't it, in the 90s?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think the numbers and the people will say anecdotally the perks also went down as well. I think working for SOM at a certain period was not unlike working for a Wall Street firm. Yeah. Change was managed by a new generation, and making a corporate structure that allows for younger people to move forward, to alter the culture, to bring new ideas in place. Of course, it's very difficult for any corporation, whether it's Microsoft or whether it's an architectural firm. And this allowed people like David Childs and for Adrian Smith in Chicago to step forward, and I think they become the next generation.
Yeah. Modernism in architecture seems to be coming back in vogue a little bit, at least critically speaking, as a style, though.
Well, I think that's true, and we may look back at some of those buildings with criticism now, but one of the things that I tried to bring out in the book, and particularly, let's say, in regard to Rose Wharf, which is one of Adrian Smith's projects, is it may be for those people formed on a modernist sensibility, you might not like this architecture, but it was so welcome in its own time. Mm-hmm. I think that SOM is also able, and not unique, to develop buildings and ideas that are as up-to-date, you want to say, as any firm. It isn't uniform, and that's the part that people find hard to accept. Nor is every building an A-class building or has A-class money attached to it. So when you build a lot and it's diverse, you may like this and not that. And again, it's hard for people on the outside to penetrate this. They think that the SOM they saw is the only SOM. Mm-hmm. This is true particularly, I would say, in Chicago, where somehow Chicago SOM is seen by people in Chicago as the true SOM.
Yeah. So, as we've said, we're looking at a firm with 10,000 projects to its credit, but I wanted to talk about a few particular buildings, maybe in New York, particularly since they're accessible to people in the listening area. And perhaps we should begin with SOM signature work, which is Gordon Bunshaft's Lever House, completed in 1950, which the then mayor of New York, Vincent Impellitteri, prophetically called the building of tomorrow, which promises to set the pattern for the city of tomorrow. And for our listeners who visit Manhattan and like to look around, it's worth a quick walk from Grand Central Terminal up Park Avenue to 53rd Street to see it, especially as it has just been fully renovated, I believe.
Yes, it's got a completely new skin on it.
And because of the way it's designed, it's actually one of the few skyscrapers in Manhattan that you can get a full view of without going out onto the East River or the Hudson River.
Yes, just go across the street, which is actually a critical place to look at it, because one of the things you see, the building consists of two parts. It's a square donut that's basically three stories high and a slab next to it, and the slab rises up. The square donut has a hole in the middle where now you can see, I think, somewhat execrable art, but you can see artwork. It was designed originally to have sculpture by Noguchi. It is a enlightened building. It brings light into the city. The city is a series of canyons, dark stone canyons. All of a sudden you have light. Don't look down Park Avenue as you see it today. Look for those buildings that are about 16 stories high, made out of masonry. You can see one just north of the bottom of Park Avenue. Mm-hmm. Those originally lined Park Avenue, with exceptions for St. Bartholomew's on the east side and the Racquet Club on the west. But basically, there were stone buildings everywhere. And all of a sudden, this building comes along that is a square donut that opens out light and air that sets the buildings at right angle to the street. So you get these spectacular views down Park Avenue from Lever House. Mm-hmm. And the building is visible. Mm-hmm. It was, as people said at the time, a building that changed their feelings about New York. All of a sudden, this was the new, and everything else was old. So it is an exciting building, and I think it remains exciting.
Yeah, it's a beautiful building.
It's the wonderful colors of green and greeny-blue curtain wall. And it sits across, although this isn't our topic, from the Seagram Tower, so you can get two for one.
So nearby, you talked a bit about it earlier, Manufacturers Trust, which was built in 1954. It said that 15,000 people went through its doors on opening day, even though they could see everything that was inside.
Because of the
glass front.
This is the building that transforms banking in America. Glass and steel. You can see your money happening. You can see it all going on in front of you. Not the building that we have today. You have to wish away a few things. Mm-hmm. There were tellers who moved around on tethers. You know, I always have to explain to students how important banks were. Most people don't go into banks very often today. They go to a wall and get their money out of an ATM machine. But in the days of yore, you had to go in every week at least to get your cash. And this was the building that swept the boards. Everybody wanted to have their money there. And everybody wanted to work there as well.
It was said that more depositors opened new accounts in the first year the bank was opened than any of the bank's branches did during any year of its history. Feeling safe, I suppose, because you could see that big vault.
Could see the big vault down there. And you could, you know, it's really the opposite of the old bank, which is about a Florentine palace with a rusticated front. Your money's safe behind. Now it's safe behind because it's transparent. And that's a new message completely. Though it's a building people walk by without even casting a glance at it. You can go up inside in the banking hours and stand up there. There's wonderful artwork there by Harry Bertoia, wonderful gold screen at the far end.
I remember not knowing what I was looking at, but many times you spill out of Grand Central, you turn the corner of Fifth Avenue, and there it is.
With a wonderful, if one can, go by at night, and if it's lit properly, it had special lighting designs by Eleanor Lemaire. They really wanted it to be like a department store on the inside. A bank as a department store? It seems nonsensical, but this was the idea, that it should be visible what happens inside. So you have the lighting levels on the inside that are rather high, and this enables you to see what goes on behind the glass.
So moving downtown, 1 Chase Manhattan Plaza and the tower on top of it, built in 1960. This and the building at 2 Broadway signaled Lower Manhattan had finally turned the corner after the Great Depression to people.
Yes, it's a building that in Lower Manhattan was facing a crisis as banks were moving uptown. I suppose it always faced crises as uptown became more popular than downtown. This was the building that was designed to bring life back to downtown. It's very interesting and will get increasingly interesting from a historical point of view to compare this to the new developments at the World Trade Center, because here's a little plaza cut out of the tight, dense streets of Lower Manhattan. It's the parallel to Rockefeller Center, uptown, if you like, with indeed a low-level Noguchi sculpture, water sculpture you look down to, not unlike Rockefeller Center uptown.
And Dubuffet's 4 trees are in the plaza,
yes,
I think.
Yes, so, yes. Gordon Bunshaft was involved in the selection of those, and a very important addition. And the photographs here also tell us a story with these pictures that show the skyline of New York, the old skyline before the World Trade Centers, with Chase Manhattan catching the light against the dark buildings around it. And this was to be modernity. This was to be the new world brought into the heart of the old city.
Also downtown, not far away, is One Liberty Plaza.
Yes.
Pronounced dead over and over by commentators on 9/11 before the smoke cleared, but seems to have survived.
It seems to have survived, yes. I mean, these are these great muscular steel buildings that are not always happy. That one certainly is a characteristic building for its period, but slightly later than Chase and really part of the renovation of it. But those are big muscular steel structures with their Corten steel, rusting Corten steel in some cases.
Yeah. Now, SOM is playing an important part in the Freedom Tower Project.
Yes.
An awful name, I know, for
World Trade Center, yes.
The design is Daniel Liebskind's, but SOM is managing the...
Well, let's be clear about a couple of things. Daniel Liebskind won the competition for the master plan, but not for the design of the building. This was never the case. It has been spun into the case by the press and by people who didn't generally understand that master planning and designing the building were two separate acts. David Childs had already been hired by Larry Silverstein to design the building. So Daniel Liebskind offered and was awarded the prize for designing the master plan. He subsequently had a powerful influence on, partly through the press, partly through the influence of George Pataki, on the terms under which the design would take place. So this 1,776 feet business was established, and the particular location was established. But Childs, in effect, had the commission from the beginning for the building, as he was Larry Silverstein's architect. It's a little complicated, but to get some sense of what will be happening, it's good to go there and see 7 World Trade Center, which is the building which is completed by SOM, which is a marvelous office tower, very green in its technical construction and structure, which is there, present, and active. So it is the place that SOM has its name. The point I want to make is that this competition between Liebskind and Childs, supposed competition as it came through the press, puts SOM very much in a position with which I think it's sometimes all too familiar. Somehow the corporate heavy that is going to crush individuality. Well, if you cast Liebskind as the person who wins the design competition, then it looks that way. If his only job was the master planning, then perhaps there's another story to tell. I think history is going to write an interesting story here.
So you're hopeful about the way the project may play out in the end?
Well,
is that a big question?
I think that's a big question, not because of SOM, but because there are a lot of people with big shoulders who are bumping against one another. It's a kind of sumo a competition.
Yeah.
And basically, the competition is over now, but resolved in ways that are quite unexpected. Mm-hmm. That is to say, the developer, Larry Silverstein, has ceded control of the building whose design he influenced completely. World Trade Center 1, the so-called Freedom Tower, has been ceded to the Port Authority. So that this is, should we say, an unexpected culmination to the story, because one would have assumed that he would keep it for rent and for development, but so it is.
And lastly, I just wanted to mention the Skyscraper Museum.
Oh, yes.
In Battery Park.
Inhabited by so many Vassar students, I can't begin to tell
Is
you.
Is it?
Yes, we have numbers of students who, Miranda Kimball, indeed, who worked with me on this book. That's a design by Roger Duffy. Mm-hmm. It's a tiny, minuscule space, but with a ceiling of mirrors, and the idea is to feel like you're coming into a skyscraper. You have a sense of disequilibrium and imbalance, and you do. Well, we have, through the grace of Carol Willis, Emma White and Miranda Kimball and Sebastian Howard are working there. So we're delighted that Vassar is connected with the
Skyscraper Museum. Oh, great. Yeah, I didn't know that. I know it has a wonderful presence on the web.
Yes, it has a great presence. But they do very interesting exhibits. Just recently completed an exhibit on Burj Dubai.
Yeah, and lots of exhibits also.
Yes.
It's very active.
And wonderful lectures. Yeah. And we're delighted that Vassar is contributing.
Yeah. I just want to mention, you do have in your appendices a map of all SOM's projects in the New York area that someone could use.
Yes.
Perhaps not all.
No. This was something that was quite interesting. I asked SOM if they could design a series of maps for Chicago, San Francisco, and New York, showing where the main projects were. We had to limit ourselves to Manhattan and downtown because it's too many. But it is possible to look and see where these projects are. And I think what people will find is they've been to so many of them without even knowing it. And sometimes that's the intention. And that's, I think, one of the other things, I guess, to bring it back to your introduction about the sense of anonymity. It's also, at certain moments, okay, indeed, especially prized by people at SOM, that they should be anonymous. Mm-hmm. Marilyn Taylor, for example, speaks movingly about the fact that there are certain places, certain kinds of buildings, whether it's subway stations, train stations, you shouldn't be conscious of the architecture. It doesn't have to leap out and jump on your head. You should just get from A to B in an efficient way, and SOM takes great pride in that. I think it's worth observing, therefore, that you often go through SOM projects, whether it's Harvard Square tea stop up in Boston, or Providence Railway Station in Rhode Island, or the monorail from Newark, without knowing that you're in an SOM SOM project.
Yeah. Fame and celebrity aren't everything. Shouldn't be.
So I hear, Tom. Yes. it's true.
Yeah. So I want to thank you, Nick, for joining us today on the Library Cafe.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the coffee. Oh, no, wait,
there was no coffee, yeah. We've been talking with Nicholas Adams, professor of art at Vassar College, about his book Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, SOM Since 1936, published by Fiden. You've been listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM, Poughkeepsie.